Welcome back to Stack Trace. I am John Sundell, and I'm joined, like always, by my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo.
Hi, John. How are you doing?
I'm great. And normally we say that this show is all about discussing Apple news and rumors from a developer's perspective. And we're still going to do that. But we actually have a very special guest with us today, who is our first guest, who is actually not a developer, which we are super excited about. And he works at Mobile Nations and iMore, and he's the host of the Vector podcast. It's Renee Ritchie. Welcome to the show, Renee.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I wrote like Visual Basic for a hot minute back in the 90s. So
that qualifies. Totally, absolutely. So it's still from a developer's perspective. Perfect. We can keep the slogan.
Awesome.
We did the background check.
Exactly. We always do our research very thoroughly here on Stack Trace.
Oh, perfect.
So on this episode, we want to focus pretty much 100% on the new iPad Pro, because as we all know, Apple held an event 2 weeks ago in New York City, showing a lot of new cool hardware, and amongst that hardware, the new iPad Pro. And I know that, Renee, you've had some time with that. You've done some reviews about both the new iPad Pro and the Apple Pencil, and I've got my iPad Pro right here as well, so I think it's going to be fun. So, Renee, you do some really cool work. You do a lot of content creation. Do you still do a new episode of Vector every single day?
Yeah, although I was doing it purely as a podcast for, I think, like the first year. And then I switched to doing it as a video show. So now I do about 4 videos a week. And those all the audio for those, because some people just want to listen while they commute. And it's a lot of it is talking head stuff, so it doesn't make a difference to them. So I put that in the podcast feed, and I'm going to start. I did a soft launch last week with an interview, and I think I'm going to do one just audio interview show a week. So it'll go back to being 5 days a week for audio.
Awesome. Yeah, that is one crazy schedule. Like, we do the show every 2 weeks, and you know, it still feels like a lot of work. So doing a new episode every day, that is quite impressive.
Well, I mean, they both have pros and cons. Like, when I was doing it weekly, there would always be stuff I wanted to talk about in between, and I'd have to wait, and then maybe something bigger would happen, and I wouldn't get a chance to talk about it. And it just, I was writing every day, so it seemed odd not to talk every day. And it sort of fits my own personal insanity better, I think.
Yeah, I think this is something that me and Rambo talk about quite a lot, is that, you know, if you take away like a lot of the kind of busy work when it comes to podcasting, like editing and setting things up, like actually doing the podcast, I think that's something that you've said, Rambo, is that you could do that like every single day all the time. Like, you would be happy doing that.
Yeah, I couldn't edit an episode every day, but I could definitely record an episode every day.
Yeah, exactly. So, Renee, you're the only one here on this podcast who has actually been to one of these events that Apple hosts when they show new products and when they do their keynotes. So what's it like when you attend an event like that? Like, how does it look like, and what's kind of the feeling when you go there?
So it's kind of cool. You get there early, and no matter how early you get there, The Verge is already in line because they probably got there the night before. They're probably camping out like at WWDC. So you say hello to them and to the event staff because they're the only people there. And they typically have something set up so you can grab some coffee and stay awake. And more people start milling in. A lot of it is media. And Apple's made a real effort to get more international with the media over the last few years. So you don't just see the same, you know, same 3 blogger people's faces. It really is people from all over the world showing up there. And they sort of corral you in front of the venue. And typically streets are closed. Or if it's at the Apple campus now, even like the street Tantau Boulevard in front of Apple Park is closed down. You go in, you sign in, you get your pass, and then you wait. I like to get there early because I'm just, you never know what's going to happen. And I figure if I'm going to get stuck in traffic or the Uber is not going to come, I'd rather get that out of the way really early than at the last minute. But right. Then you'll see like Gruber and Dalrymple stroll in at 3 seconds before the event starts and take their place. Right. And then like you're in the theater, you're milling, people are like trying to get the best seats. It's gotten funny in the last couple of years because there's a few people, I won't name their names, but you'll probably figure out who they are, who just want to live stream everything. And then they fight over who's live streaming what at what time. And that's always adorable to watch. And finally, the lights sort of go down. You mingle for a while. You talk to each other. You see people you haven't seen for a while, which is really nice. And as always, Apple people, you know, they have special guests like Al Gore, which they don't let you near. They're probably in some other section somewhere.
Are they like in a little glassed off section, like in the special section of an arena or something like that?
Yeah, well, they're in the front row. And that's why like there's Johnny Ive and Phil Schiller and Dan Riccio and Johnny Cerugi and all the Apple executives in the front row. And, Greg Joswiak and all of that. And they're usually sitting with a few of their special guests. And then, you know, the music will they'll tell you that it's starting in a couple minutes. Everyone will sit down. And then the lights go down and Tim Cook comes out lately in a sweater vest, which is really, really cool.
Yeah.
And says, good morning. Good morning.
Exactly. That's a good impression.
Thank you. And kicks everything off. And then you sit through the event, which everybody gets to see. And then immediately, if it's not like purely software, if it's not the WWDC keynote with absolutely no hardware, people will start racing to get to the hands-on area because everybody has their video or their hands-on or their photos or whatever. And there's always, the space is always too limited and the amount of devices available are too limited. So you just got to fight for your few minutes with whatever the latest hotness is. And then it's the rest of the day just writing and filming about it.
Yeah, that's really cool. It almost looks a little bit, when you see some of this kind of footage and some photos that people have taken of the hands-on area, it looks almost like, you know, people who wanted to take a selfie with like the Eiffel Tower or something or some other like big landmark in a city. You know, everyone is like trying to get that perfect angle for that selfie, you know, and trying to get everyone else out of the way so it won't look so crowded.
Yeah, and they want their picture with Tim Cook, which I think it's not a selfie. It's like a Timmy. No, Timmy is Tim Hortons. It's a cookie. No, cookies used with something. Or with Craig Federighi or with somebody, which is always awesome.
So when you're in the hands-on area, what's your kind of goal? Like, is it to just play around with as many of the devices as possible? Or are you trying to, you know, get down some kind of first initial thoughts or to actually do something? Like, do you have some really like concrete goal in mind when you try a new device for the first time?
So like you're trying to juggle many, many things at once. One is like getting photos and just trying out the device and trying to see what new features they mentioned on stage are actually like haptic touch, for example, on the 10R, just whatever new thing they announced you want to see in action.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's staffed by Apple marketing and you have some people who like some of the iPads are, it's all hands on deck basically. So some of the people in the iPad section, for example, are the people who've been working on that project for years. But other times, because they need everyone they can get, it's marketing people who don't have products in that event. Like, for example, iPhone marketing, who they're just helping out. So what I try to do is find people who I know work on the team for the device that's being shown off because they know it so deep that you can ask questions. And I always like asking about accessibility because it often gets stage time, but not always. And there's often new accessibility features that go with any new product. And also if there's like confusion, if I've seen confusion on Twitter, because everybody always assumes the worst. The minute Apple announces something, it means they're taking something else away from you.
Yeah, so exactly.
I try to ask those questions.
I remember when the iPhone 10 was announced and people were going crazy because, oh, what about the notch? And what about there's no home button? How do you shut down the device? And all those questions that we know the answer now, and it's just so simple, but people always assume the worst.
Or I tweeted for the iPhone 10, I tweeted that it was a Pentile display and no one in the hands-on area could tell, and that got me grief for so long.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, people are worried that Apple forgot something, right? That they forgot the on switch or something on the device. You know? It's like, whoops, we accidentally shipped 100 million iPhones without an on switch.
Yeah, or they want to know, like, is what Core i processor is in the new MacBook Air, and is it this, and can you test that? And I mean, there's just so many things. Everyone has their sort of area of interest that they're desperate to find out about.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. So going back a little bit to your work that you're doing with Vector and iMore and things like that, Vector is a quite new project. I mean, not super new. You've been doing it for about a year or something like that, right?
Yeah, I did a version a long time ago where I just wanted to talk to interesting people, and I had like Brian Klug and Anand Shimpi when, you know, before they disappeared into Apple.
Right.
And just a lot of different technical guests. People talk about radios because I wanted to learn more about those subjects. But I didn't have time to keep doing it. So I stopped for a while. And then I got back into it because there were so many things. And also, not everybody could just read the articles. And I heard from a lot of people who were like, oh, you know, is there an audio version of this? Or, you know, can they get us another format? And it made sense to me that we are such a multimedia society now that just presenting print content all the time and letting sort of screen readers or something else take the burden wasn't the best experience. So I started mixing in audio versions of the writing and also doing interviews because for various reasons I couldn't do Debug anymore, which was a podcast I really loved doing with Guy English.
And we really love listening to it. Yeah.
Yeah, he's not allowed the tech podcast anymore. So we have to wait until he gets himself fired and then we can do it all over again. But yeah, so, and I love doing that and I wanted an outlet. And I did iterate with Mark Edwards. And, you know, he had a baby and Seth, the two co-hosts had babies and they got really busy and it was hard to keep going. So I wanted a place where I could sort of bring, basically, I was doing six podcasts. A bunch of them couldn't be done anymore. And I wanted a place to sort of bring them all together. So on any given day, I could do a design show or a development show or a technical show or an, you know, a fun entertainment show and just have a place for all of it.
Yeah, that's really cool. I guess that's also a big benefit of the kind of daily or very like quick format is that you can have that freedom to experiment with different topics, right? Like when you're doing a show like every second week or every week, you usually want to stick to, you know, that scope of that show because you have so much build up that you want to talk about. But when you do like one show every day or something, you can really kind of iterate, right? And experiment quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, and I called it a variety show. And some weeks I did nothing but back-to-back interviews, and some weeks I did nothing but back-to-back editorial stuff. And I really could do anything on any given day, and I enjoyed that a lot.
No, that's really cool. Awesome. And you also do a bunch of work for iMore and things like that. Is that still kind of also one of your main focuses, like actually written content and articles and things like that? Or are you more kind of pivoting, as they say, into more like video and audio and things like that?
No, so what I did for my own sanity was I made Vector a thing. So I try to do every day one video that's also a podcast and that's also text content. So that if you like to read, you can read it. If you like to watch, you can watch it. If you like to listen, you can listen to it. And it's sort of inspired by Joanna Stern, who does this column for the Wall Street Journal, which is just right. Tremendous, where she does like a really creative review for something and you can read it in the Wall Street Journal or you can watch it on YouTube. And it just made sense to me to sort of that model could work and that it could scale. And so like, it's nowhere near Joanna Stern quality, but I try to do that every day and just have something on what I think is an interesting topic that you can choose however you want to sort of read it or watch it.
I love her reviews.
They're so good.
Yeah, hers are like on the list that I have to watch with every new product, and alongside yours and MKBHD as well. Yeah. I love his reviews.
Oh yeah.
So those I always make sure I watch, and I prefer to watch them in 4K. So yeah. I can't use my Apple TV, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's VP. Is it VP9? Is it they're on now?
Yeah, VP9, I guess.
But I think the new audio is an A something. That new video codec is going to make everything work beautifully and magically again.
Is it finally the thing that, you know, we have 100 standards, we just need another standard, it's going to fix everything?
Yeah, I forget the name. Is it A1 or A10 or something? But there's the next standard is supposed to just be supported by Apple and Google, and finally there can be peace in our time.
Oh, finally. Fantastic. Yeah, that's great. All right, so now we want to start moving into our main topic, which is, of course, talking all about the iPad Pro. But before we do, we want to reveal our results of our keynote poker. So before the keynote, on our last episode, we played some poker, me and Rambo, betting on what we think is going to happen. And we did a little bit better this time than during our WWDC episode, where we got, Rambo, what did we get? Like -1 and +1 or something like that? It was very close to zero.
I think I got like -4 or something.
Yeah, something like that. So this time you did a lot better. You got 31 points, which is really good.
So did I win?
I also got 31 points.
Oh.
So this round of poker we thought was going to show who was going to be the winner of 2018, but it turns out 2018 became a tie. But maybe we can find something else to kind of break that tie. So if you, dear listener, have some idea on how we can break the tie, like some game that we can play or something, then make sure to tweet us at StackTracePod with your ideas, and we can see if we can do something fun to break this tie and see who's going to win 2018.
Yeah, and the game can't be like, who does the most prototypes on iPad Pro?
I think that's a great game. I think that's very fair. All right, so let's talk about the iPad Pro. I'm super excited about that. First of all, let's start with a little bit of a recap with what's actually new with the new iPad Pro models. So Renee, you want to give us a quick recap of what has changed in this generation of iPad Pro?
I mean, I was going to start off complaining that I don't have Animoji Studio for iPad Pro yet. But
that's what's new.
I can start. That's all I want. I mean, then my life would be complete. Just sit there and make Animoji karaoke all day on my iPad Pro.
Exactly. I need an iPad Pro before I can do Animoji Studio for iPad Pro. Oh,
someone get him an iPad. No, so, I mean, I think first up is just the silicon, the A12. See, I'm going to call it the A12-10 because Apple has trained me to say the letter X like a 10 now, and I can't stop.
Right.
The A12X processor, which, you know, it benchmarks at recent generation Core i7 levels, which is just stupefying. And it has just so much power in such a small, comparatively small footprint. And, you know, you don't need all that right now. Maybe if you are doing ARKit or Core ML or, you know, a bunch of really advanced computational photography, that kind of stuff, you might still peg it. But it's just got so much headroom for so much software going forward that it's exciting to me just as somebody who loves seeing what Apple does with custom silicon, that every time you think they've sort of pushed it pretty far for mobile, now you're saying, oh, they're square in desktop class territory right now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really impressive to see what they've done with their chips. And it's funny because Moore's Law has kind of died off in the rest of the tech industry, but Apple, they're still in full Morse mode going forward with every new generation.
Yeah, and just what they're adding, like they've got the CPU and the GPU, and that's fine, but they've got the neural engine now up to 8 cores. But it's all the other stuff that I find so interesting. Like they have custom encode and decode blocks for HEVC, which is the video encoding, so they can just chew through that stuff faster than, you know, faster than Intel silicon can. And they have custom controllers that handle how they allocate processing between the different units that lets them fire one processor, a different processor, all the processors, or how the neural engine sort of intelligently start to learn how to schedule this stuff. And when you look at all the controllers, which let them read and write super fast, it's really a very sophisticated approach to sort of a very modern chipset.
Yeah, absolutely. And fast-tracking audio and video in hardware, I think, is a really smart move. Because I think this is, again, where you can gain these like huge leaps forward. We won't always be able to just add more transistors because now they're at the 7-nanometer process. Yeah. So it's going to be, you know, eventually physics are going to catch up. But if we can fast-track some of these very common tasks in hardware, that's, you know, still going to make a huge impact.
Well, can you imagine that keynote when they start getting to quantum levels and they'll say like, oh, we have 8 gazillion transistors sometimes.
Exactly.
Maybe not.
Yeah, we both do and do not have.
Yeah, exactly. But are the transistors really there if no one is watching them, right?
Yeah, or once you watch them, they change.
I mean, exactly. Maybe Apple should add a hardware fast track, like a dedicated hardware for compiling Swift code. Or what do you think, Rambo?
I think that's necessary.
I'm just worried they're not going to transition to ARM on the Mac before they have to transition to quantum on the Mac. I mean, like, the window is closing.
Exactly. Nice. So we've got the A12X, which is a, you know, crazy fast integrated whole package system on a chip, GPU, neural engine, everything. Super fast and really fluid, and it really tells when you're using the device.
And 4 gigs and 6 gigs of RAM sandwiched in between them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The 6 gigs is weird because it's just on the 1 terabyte model. And I guess the popular line is that it's there because you need to handle greater storage. But having iOS devices, for all their power, still massively RAM constrained compared to Macs or PCs, where now you have like what a Mac Mini with 64 gigabytes of storage, but you still have to deal with now AutoCAD and incoming Photoshop with usually 2, 3, 4, maybe 6 gigabytes of RAM. And to me, that's very interesting from, like, I'm glad I'm not the one who has to code those things.
Rambo, have you seen any interesting things in the software or in the when you've been spelunking, like why the larger iPad is the only one that has the 6 gigabytes of RAM?
Not seen anything, but I've heard that it's apparently necessary to handle the terabyte of storage for some reason. I don't know if it's some sort of buffer or something.
Okay, interesting. Could it also be something that has to do with like swapping? Because I know that iOS doesn't really do swapping at the moment. Apps have to kind of do it on their own. But could it be something like that? Like in order to be able to deal with larger storage, like to be able to swap things from memory, they need more memory or something like that?
Maybe it's the opposite of swapping. Like they have to copy the data into RAM for some reason when they're doing stuff with it. I'm just guessing. But what I've heard is that it's necessary for the 1 terabyte to work. I should actually look into it a little bit more to see if I can find any reason.
Yeah, that'd be really interesting. Maybe it's like, you know, sometimes when you buy something, like you buy yogurt and you get muesli, right? Maybe it's like you buy that terabyte hard drive that comes for free, the RAM. So Apple was like, well, we can just stick that in the device, I guess.
Yeah, we know where else to put it.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. So we've got great RAM, of course. That's a great big upgrade, good for future-proofing the device as well. And we've got the same great screen, but with ProMotion and all that stuff. But yep. We've got also some cool new features with the screen with the Liquid Retina display.
Yeah, I mean, I think Liquid Retina is literally their marketing name for doing the anti-aliasing and pixel masking, which is really cool technology to make. So they deleted the bezels, well, a lot of the bezels. If you've always hated bezels, if you've always wanted bezels to die, then Apple has given you at least half of your wish with the new iPad Pro. And in order to get that new rounded look, very similar to the XR, they've gone in and sort of done their best to sculpt. And it's pretty remarkable because this is LCD. It's not OLED where you can like fold displays and do all sorts of fancy stuff. They've gone in and pushed the LCD as far as they can in the backlight, the LED backlight, as far as they can towards the edge. And then done everything they can to make those corners, even at iPad resolution, which is lower than iPhone XR resolution, which is lower than just about any other phone resolution. It still made the curves look pretty good.
Yeah, I was playing around with the XR yesterday, and it's very impressive. Yeah. I could definitely use the device. Of course, I prefer the OLED, but I know some people who don't actually prefer the OLED because they have issues with flickering or something.
Yeah, it's vertigo-inducing.
Yeah, it's weird. I never noticed anything like that. But I was looking at the corners like really closely, and I couldn't see any defects, like in the way they rounded the corners. And there was someone on the store, and they were like, "Oh, but look, this one has bigger borders around it." And I was dying to explain it to them that there are physical limitations still with LCD.
Yeah, well, I mean, people, OLED. You mentioned before, some people do get vertigo because they do a bunch of things with frequency to try to mitigate. OLED is a wonderful technology that is also terrible and requires an incredible amount of mitigation to make it even usable. And that includes like the off-axis shifting, but also things like burn-in. And they do a lot of frequency modulation to prevent burn-in, which some people, they can't see it, but they can, their eyes take it in, and it really makes them sick. So they have to stick with LCD. And the iPad sticks with LCD, and some people are, you know, Apple can't even do OLED in 2018, lame. But OLED is super expensive. at iPad scale, getting panels that size is probably prohibitive still, because really only Samsung can manufacture to Apple's design requirements. And that's why Apple and Google are throwing money at LG as fast as they can. But also, my understanding is the technology to consistently provide brightness to HDR levels on those panels isn't possible yet either. Like you'd have sort of, it would be brighter in the middle or on the edges, one or the other, and it wouldn't be the same consistent brightness they can get on a phone. And Apple just will not ship until that works the way they want it to work.
Yeah, and then there's ProMotion. I wonder if that's possible with OLED.
Yeah, no, that's true too, because they have to do the frequency variance to stop burn-in, and that might interfere with the frequency variance.
If you're getting sick with a 60 FPS flicker, imagine 120 FPS flicker.
Sick. Yeah, flickering right into your eyes. Yeah, flickering retina, that could be the display name. I somehow doubt that Apple is going to name it that. But yeah.
Registering the domain right now, sir.
Yeah. Awesome. So yeah, the screen is obviously a big new feature, and the shrunken bezels really, like, we've been talking about it on the show before, but I really feel this way, and I know Rambo, you feel this way too about like these devices, that you look at these, and for me, I just see this like big canvas where I can just put anything I want. And it may sound like a little bit weird to say it like that, but I really like feel like when the bezels are removed, like the device just becomes your content. It becomes your screen. Yeah. And in my case, it becomes just something where I can build and I can render whatever I want on. And that is just incredibly inspiring.
And that's what Steve Jobs said about the first iPhone. If you remember, he was talking about the advantage of having this giant screen, which is funny to say now. He was explaining that the advantage is that you could make it become anything.
Yeah, exactly. It can become whatever you can imagine it to become. Or in this case, whatever your Swift code can make it become.
It's a giant window into web and apps. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's really, really cool. Nice. We've also got some changes to the ports. So instead of a headphone jack, we now have USB-C.
Yeah, headphone and lightning. You get one for the price of two.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so I mean, my favorite thing, and I know this is horrible to say, but one of my favorite things with the Apple TV 4K was watching everybody in the rather sheltered Apple ecosystem suddenly have to come face to face with the true horrors that is HDMI. And now you have the same thing. Like, yes, we've had USB-C since 2015 with the 12-inch MacBook, but a lot of people really haven't been dealing with it. And now that it's on the iPad, all of a sudden, all these people who are otherwise so techie have to come face to face with the abject terror that everyone in Android and you know, Google land has had to deal with for the last few years, to the point of Google engineers having to rate these damn cables on Amazon to tell you which ones are actually safe to use. And now we're like going, oh, this one is power. This one is data, but not power. Ah, oh, this is Thunderbolt 3, but is that the same as USB-C? And I'm so confused.
Yeah.
Yeah, because now it's all the same part, but not all cables are equal. So you have this issue, like I believe the cable that comes with the device is power only, right?
Yeah, so, well, no, it does minimum data, but I don't think it does. Like, for example, you can't drive a display with it.
Yeah, I think the core that comes with the iPad itself is only USB 2.0. So it's not USB 3.0. So it's
And they go to 3.1 now, which is 10 gigabits per second. If you get the right cable. But again, you've got to get the right cable.
Yeah, that's the funny thing. You know, when I got my 4K display and I wanted to connect it to my computer, I tried like all HDMI cables I had in the house. And they would all just render at 30 frames per second, like with 30 hertz. And then I just thought, well, maybe I will try to use the HDMI cable that came with my PlayStation Pro that I haven't used, because I already had an HDMI cable that I just plugged in. And it turned out that was the magic HDMI 2.0 cable that I needed. And there was no telling from the cable, right? It was just like, try to plug them all in and see which one that worked.
Yeah, digital isn't digital anymore, because you add length matters and the quality of the shielding in the cable matters. And if you want to get 444 HDR out, like, it's almost like you go through a box of cables and find the one that works. You don't know
exactly
why.
Yeah. That's very,
I'm
very
adding
funny.
Like I'm adding a good USB-C 3.1 cable to my shopping list here.
Yeah, and you have to do that, and I'm sure some people are now like, I just wanted Apple to go to USB-C, and now I just want my Lightning back because it was just one damn cable and it always worked.
Yeah. Yeah, USB-C is definitely more complicated, but at the same time, it's really cool to see kind of the whole ecosystem moving forward, because I mean, that's kind of the USB-C dream, right? That all devices will have the same connector. They will all work the same way. You can use the same peripherals. If you need to take a trip to Dongle Town, maybe you'll only have to take that trip once, right? It's a one-way stop. It's a one-way trip to Dongle Town. That part excites me. But at the same time, it's probably going to be a bit confusing still for a while.
Yeah, and because iOS 12 is still iOS 12, like I got some good criticism on my review because I just reviewed the hardware because I figured iOS 12 was a known quantity. It had been out for almost 4 months and nothing had changed in that story. But when you start looking at the capabilities of the new iPad Pro on a hardware level, and you see you can plug in USB-C, but people have to, it's not like a Mac and it's not like Windows, it's not even like Linux where you plug stuff in and as long as you can find the driver, it'll probably work. On Linux, I mean, like on macOS, it'll just work. You plug in, like theoretically external storage works, but iOS has no concept of it. Like, God forbid you can just plug it in and File Picker will pop up the way Photo Picker will when you pop in an SD card, because you know that would just be crazy. So you got to find an app that understands external storage and can do that for you. And then you start getting, it's like this thing. Sometimes you have your mindset on a certain level of simplicity and you will do untold amounts of complexity to stick to that vision. You know, like I don't want a settings panel, so I'll make everything else so complicated so I don't have to have the complexity of a settings panel. Or I don't want to have a file system, so I'll basically doom people to app silos where they'll never remember which app they wrote which letter in ever again, but I won't have a file system. And I think iOS is still paying the price for that sort of initial pre-iOS 6 thinking.
Let's use this to transition a little bit to talk about the software, because I think we have some thoughts. And I think we both can agree that it looks like this device came out with not the software it was intended to come out with, right?
Yeah, it's ahead of its time, right? In it sounds like a marketing slogan, but it feels like it's literally ahead of its time. Like it's supposed to have a more capable version of iOS to match it.
I mean, that feels right. Like the rumors were that iOS 12 was supposed to have more in it until it got pushed back to make room for a lot of the optimization stuff that was done this year instead. And you can imagine a different world where a lot of stuff that was meant for this device actually shipped before this device came out. And then you wouldn't have, I think, quite so many ornery, angry tech nerds in their reviews.
Yeah, exactly. Because I really feel when I look at this, especially with the Files app, that being able to read from external drives must be in the cards. Like, I'd be very, very surprised if that doesn't happen. But at the same time, I can understand why it was postponed, because, you know, it may seem very simple when we think about it the first time. Like, you know, it's USB-C, just plug in a drive, how hard can it be? You know, probably we can just read it out of the box. But then we have all these edge cases, right? And different drives are formatted with different file systems, and you plug in a Windows drive, and you plug in some other drive. And
FAT32.
Exactly, right? And I'm sure that a lot of that would also require kind of underlying changes to the OS in order to be able to understand a lot of those files, be able to pass them around to different apps, be able to, you know, pass a file into an app sandbox and things like that. So I can definitely see that that would have been one of those features that was supposed to be in iOS 12, but then, you know, someone said, you know what, this is too big of a change, it's too complex, let's postpone it to iOS 13 instead.
Yeah, and features are not done in isolation. I think our developer audience will understand this a lot, that you sometimes you have this new feature, but it requires high amounts of refactoring behind the scenes and introducing new subsystems. And maybe there are even some user interface considerations that were ready for iOS 13 when they had to go back and work on iOS 12 as this performance update that it was.
Yeah.
And it's also, like, I think still to this day, there is a huge philosophical divide about what an iPad is supposed to be. In previous years, there was a huge divide between people who believed that the iPad had to remain an incredibly accessible computer for everybody who was alienated by traditional computers. And the iPhone was the same thing up until about iOS 6, up until Craig took over. Things like AirDrop were just denied year after year because it was too complicated and mainstream people didn't want that thing. And Craig has absolutely skewed nerdier with a lot of the features that have been introduced. And I think Apple as a company has let iPad grow up beyond what a lot of previous administrations would have allowed or would have seen, but it still hits those wallets, and you still have people who desperately advocate that this should be the computer that your parents and your child can pick up and just use, where you have other people who just see that hardware and lust after it and want it not just to do what the Mac does, but basically just be their Mac. And I think there's a very good middle ground in between that, but it's hard to get everybody to see that all the time.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean that the iPad needs to become a classic computer. I think that there are things that can be done to make it more powerful without compromising on the people who don't want the power. So I guess we can use the phrase progressive disclosure. Like you can use the basic features very easily, but you can also do more powerful things. And I don't think at least most people who are complaining and asking for more power on the software side are asking for macOS on iPad. They still want iOS, but they want a better iOS.
Yeah, well, some people just want Finder. Like, they'll just tell you, just give me Finder. Like, a couple of macOS things, they just want it. But I think if you look back at the history, like how copy and paste came, you know, as slowly as it came, and how drag and drop came, again, as slowly as it came, that Apple doesn't want to just take Mac paradigms and duplicate them. on iPad. But even if it's glacial in its pace, they want to find authentic two-touch interface ways of implementing that or providing that functionality. And I love that sort of approach because, and I've said this before, so forgive me if it's repetitive, but the worst thing in tech support is someone to tell you a solution they want rather than a problem that they have, because there could be like five better ways to address those. And just saying like, I want Finder, to me is like, no, what problem do you have? And let me figure out, like, the iOS 4 was great because people were like, we need multitasking. And they're like, what do you really need? I just want Pandora while I surf Safari. Okay, here's an API. And it's way better than just unrestricted multitasking. And, you know, certainly that got better. But I think it's a much better approach to sort of list the problems that you need fixed than just to tell them you want Finder or something.
Yeah, and if you think about most complaints people have about iOS on iPad, I believe most of them could be solved by having a specific launcher for the iPad. So, like, make Springboard great on iPad.
Maybe even having a specific launcher for the iPad Pro, right? Like, if we want the base model iPad to be like the everybody's computer, super easy to use, just pick it up, watch Netflix, you know, browse the web, but take away all the complications, kind of, you know, making it a pro version of iOS, like iOS Pro, which runs on maybe the highest end of iPhones, and the iPad Pro that enables some of these more advanced capabilities like file management, like, you know, more advanced multitasking, maybe pointer support and things like that.
They could call it Pro OS.
Pro OS. I like it.
Like, it's kind of not fair because Watch OS has Cascade. I think it's still called... No, it's not Cascade. It's... I forget the UI layer on the watch. It's Carousel.
Yeah,
and there's Carousel. Headboard and whatever the other board is on Apple TV. And
they have many boards.
They have so many boards now. They used to just be a thick springboard, and now there's so many boards.
It's just a whole big layer of boards.
But iPad deserves its own, like, it deserves its own first interface level. And I can't say I know what that is. Like, maybe it's a dashboard. Maybe it's more search-centric. I don't know, but it just feels like... as much as some things work being a bigger version of the iPhone, the home screen by itself does not.
Yeah, it's actually funny that you say search-centric, because the iPad Pro, the new one, is actually the first iPad I've had since the iPad 3. So I've been away from the iPad for a long time. And
significant upgrade.
Yeah, significant upgrade. I'm like, wow, this thing's
really
fast.
Especially that GPU.
Yeah, exactly. So, and one thing that I've been kind of surprised with how I use this device is... So I connected my keyboard, my Bluetooth keyboard to it, and I'm using search all the time. Like, I'm barely not touching the home screen. Like, just command space, command space, command space. Like, I'm almost always bringing up Spotlight to actually use that as an app launcher, kind of how I use Spotlight on the Mac to do that. So, you know, it kind of makes sense that I use it this way, but it's just that the home screen for me is just very hard to navigate, and when everything is just a command space away, then, you know, why not use that instead?
Yeah, I love the idea of the shelf. Like, I think the one that Vitici did still had the traditional springboard with the icons. But I feel like the home screen on iPad should be more like a shelf where you just put things and they could be like documents or little snippets that you're working on. And maybe could show attached storage as well. So... kind of like the desktop, but like a modern version of a desktop.
What do you guys think about AI? So, like, Apple's done this for a while with Siri suggested apps, and Google's doing this a lot with Pi. I think the latest version is Pi. I would get confused by the dessert names. Pi is that they're going to try to predict the apps that you want and put them in a convenient location. And I both love and hate this because I've grown up with the app grid, the permanency, object permanency of the app grid, making it almost muscle memory. Like, I just know where those apps are and I can tap them without thinking. And it would be nice if apps that I didn't use all the time, but I used every morning when I woke up, for example, were just pre-populated and easy to get to space. But then at the same time, I'd be like, oh, my apps moved. I'm so confused now. I'm a human and my brain doesn't adapt.
Yeah, I think it can work, but I don't think it's a pro feature. I think that's more for regular usage of devices. So John mentioned using Spotlight a lot on his iPad, and I use it a lot on my iPhone. And I've been using it a lot more lately, and I noticed that the Siri suggestions are getting really good. Like, most of the time when I want to launch something that's not immediately visible on my home screen, I just pull down and it's suggested by Siri.
Yeah.
I would love, I forget what it was called. I think WebOS called it Just Type and BlackBerry had something like it. And of course, Alfred on OS X, sorry, macOS does that. But just the ability to say like, tweet Guillermo, how are you doing today? And hit enter and it just does it for me. And I could just type all sorts of basic actions like Siri for type and just have it handle those things without me having to change context of taking my hands away from the keyboard.
Yeah, I have type to Siri enabled on my Mac and I use a function space to bring it up. And it's really cool. I pretty much never want to talk to Siri on my Mac, but I type to it all the time and it works great.
Love that.
That's really cool.
Pro tip.
I think that what you said there earlier, Renee, about the muscle memory, that's the part also for me that is kind of, in conflict. Where, yeah. For example, when I launch Spotlight and I will get those Siri suggestions, as Rambo says, a lot of the times they will actually be correct, but my muscle memory is to type the name of the app, right? So I will just ignore that suggestion and type the name of the app anyway. So I think that perhaps surfacing them in these places that they're currently surfaced, like, you know, in search, when I'm already in search, I have kind of a mission in mind and I'm going to just, you know, do that mission and get out. While if they were surfaced in other places, perhaps, you know, like this shelf idea, for example, or maybe give them some space on the home screen, even like before you even open the device, to be able to quickly launch into something like, you know, it's 9 a.m. in the morning. You usually open Twitter at this time. Maybe that would even be like on the lock screen to just tap one tap and you're into Twitter.
They did that. Remember they used to have predictive apps in the corners of the display and those kind of gradually went away.
Yeah, but yeah. They were also so kind of not very prominently featured, right?
Yes.
Like you just had like this very like low alpha icon in the bottom corner. It was almost like, no, this feature exists. It was almost like there was some engineer coming up with this feature and they wanted to make this engineer happy. So they put it in, but they put it like in the corner with like alpha 0.3 or something.
Or we're calling, we have a new thing called Siri Suggestions and we need more stuff to actually put in this envelope. So please come up with a few more things we can call Siri Suggestions. I was going to say, what do you guys think about, because there's another big debate is, I don't want to call it mouse support because to me, again, that just sounds like traditional computing, but some form of non-touch based interface selection, like whether it's Focus UI from the Apple TV, but just some way to sort of navigate without having to take your hands off the smart keyboard and paw at the screen.
I totally think they should give you that option, whether it's like a trackpad, and especially when you think about using external displays. I also believe they should provide an external display with touch support.
Yes.
Which would be great.
Yeah, that would be amazing. That would be really cool. I definitely agree. I think that the iPad has a potential for, you know, designed right. And again, it's this kind of glacier speed design that you talked about earlier, Renee, like making these slow iterations and really figuring things out. But hopefully, like in the future, like the ultimate version of the iPad for me is a device that is extremely versatile in the way that you can connect, like you can connect it to a display, you can connect the mouse to it, you can just use it with touch, you can use it with the pencil, and everything just works, right? And that would be extremely powerful because if people want to use the mouse, because that's how what they're comfortable with, and maybe when you're sitting in front of your desk, you can, but when you're, you know, sitting in bed, you might just want to use the pencil, just use your fingers, and I think that would be really cool to have all those options.
I think I can talk about this because I don't think this has gone forward, but a few years ago, there was this beautiful dream of a next generation operating system that would be completely contextual, that it would just be like the same basic thing running on all devices, and it would just understand if there was a touchscreen and understand if there was a mouse and understand if there was a keyboard and provide whatever interface it needed for those things. And they may do a different version of that one day, but I think that's sort of where everything needs to head.
Yeah, it's kind of the ultimate expression of computing in general, right? This like extremely adaptive device that just, you know, adapts to you and how you want to work instead of the other way around.
You have endpoints that handle your authentication and the local instantiation of your files, and you can just work on whichever one you happen to prefer or need at the time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and it works very well in theory, where like, let's just have one OS and it's going to run on all devices. But we've seen attempts to do that, and they weren't so successful. But I've talked about this before on this show, I think. I believe strongly that a desktop interface won't work very well for touch, but you can use a touch interface on a desktop. It's not perfect, but it gets the job done very well. And you can see that with Marzipan apps on Mojave. They are obviously not perfectly optimized for desktop, but they work, and they work a lot better than if you try to like get Photoshop from Mac running on an iOS device.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And I did a bunch of prototypes this last week about actually improving the pointer support on iOS using the Apple Pencil.
Yeah.
And I really think that this could be a way to go, like kind of hitting some kind of middle ground between having like a mouse or a touchpad, but actually using the pencil for things like being able to use the pencil to drag to do boxed selection when you have like a grid of photos, for example, or to be able to select text with the Apple Pencil. Because I think, like you mentioned earlier, which was, you know, people say, you know, I want Finder, but that's not really what you want. You just want to achieve a task. And I feel like it's a little bit the same with mouse support. Like people say, I want a mouse, but what do you really want to do? Maybe you want to select text. You want to select multiple items in a grid and things like that. And I think a lot of these more like precision-based tasks can actually be achieved with the Apple Pencil.
Yeah, I mean, mutual friend Steve Troughton Smith has, a small hit list of things that for him would take it over the top and make it the universal computer, not of his dreams maybe, but of his today. And I think, you know, those sorts of things are what I hope to see. And are they going to call it iOS 13 or are they going to be superstitious and just go to 14?
Just like hotel rooms, like there's no room number 13. Or maybe just iOS 10, right?
iOS X. My head will explode. I'll never iOS be able to say that correctly.
It's like Xbox One, right? It's the
or they'll
but
rename
not the
it
first
Apple
one.
OS, like all the other stuff have been renamed.
You're completely wrong. They're going to call the brand new OS for iPads iOS Max.
Of course.
No, because then iMac will sue because they're so litigious.
All right, so speaking about the Apple Pencil, Renee, you also did a dedicated review for the Apple Pencil, which I really loved. Like, that was such a beautifully done video. I had no idea that you were such an artist, like, that you were so good at drawing.
That's all I did when I was a kid. It was my misspent youth that kept me off the streets. I just came home every day from school, pretended I had no homework, and drew comic books all day.
That's amazing. Yeah, I saw that a lot of the illustrations were superhero themed, so...
Yeah.
Were you maybe a little bit inspired by Serenity's review? Was it earlier this year? Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. So if people aren't familiar, Serenity Caldwell worked at iMore for several years and did these amazing Apple Pencil on Apple Pencil reviews. And she did an iPad, the new iPad review on the iPad. And they were just brilliant. But she got stolen by Apple earlier this year and was not available to do it. So I sort of strapped on my Serenity pencil and tried my best to do something similar.
Nice. Yeah, it was really, really cool. So what's your impressions of this iteration of the Apple Pencil? Like, how does it feel compared to the previous one? And does it make you like more productive? And is it easier to draw with it?
I really like it. So it's instead of being glossy, it's got a more matte finish. And it gets rid of the cap on the back, which I lost. Like, I lost the pencil all the time, but I'd lose that cap even faster than I'd lose the pencil. It's just one thing. And instead of charging over lightning, because lightning is gone now, and USB-C is bigger than lightning, it just charges inductively. It magnetically attaches to the side of the iPad. As soon as it connects, it pairs, starts to charge, and it does it so well, and it's so convenient that essentially you forget that it charges. And yeah, it'll quick charge if you're drawing for hours and you run out of juice, it'll quick charge. And if you leave it lying on the ground, or on the table, it'll go into super low power mode. But basically, it's just always charged. It's like AirPods. It has a lot of that sort of AirPod, even the thunk sound it makes when you put it. I like the Death Star tractor beam that sucks it onto the side of the iPad. It has that feeling, that real tactility of the AirPods. And there's still things about it that aren't my favorite. But I used Wacom for years, and when I used to work in design, and I used Intuos and Cintiq. And the minute Apple announced the first Apple Pencil, it was like with the Apple Watch bands. They just leapfrogged decades of industry complacency. And this is a really solid iteration on that, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I love how it snaps onto the iPad, because
so
I just love magnets so much. Like, magnets are just the best.
Yeah, I never forget, but they've got to raid poles to sort of make sure it pulls into exactly the right position.
Yeah, and the way like it really like guides the iPad as well. You can just kind of hover it over the side of the iPad and it will just find its own way to where it's supposed to connect. And it's just really, really elegant.
It's a Hallback array or something like that. I forget the scientific name.
Yeah,
I remember showing off MagSafe to friends when it was cool, and I was like the only person who had a Mac, and people always went crazy when you just like approached the Mac with the cable and it snapped into place. Magnets are really cool.
They're magic.
Yeah, and it's so funny because they are so basic. You can't kind of on a conceptual level, but the way that we've started using them now in so many products, instead of having these like annoying things that had to lock in place, like for example strapping on a cover on a device, like now the new smart keyboard folio and the cover that Apple makes, they all connect through magnets as well.
Remember the first one came out, was it the iPad 2, I think? It came out and it just had the smart cover and you could peek and the magnets would open it and close it. And now that thing has more magnets than I think the North Pole. It's just amazing. People are like just slapping it on the side of their fridge. It's amazing.
Yeah, don't hold your compasses close to your iPad. You're going to see the North Pole in your living room. Yeah, that's really cool.
And just so for completeness sake, because this wouldn't be stack trace without code names, that connector for the Apple Pencil is technically called the magnetic connector, codename Scorpius.
Nice.
Scorpius. Yeah, that's really cool.
Nice.
Yeah, for me, the Apple Pencil is very interesting. Like, I'm not an artist at all. Like, I could probably not draw my way out of a life-threatening situation. Hopefully, I will never have to do that. But I find the Apple Pencil super cool anyway. Like, I use it a lot for just drawing out, like, architectures and code solutions. And I also use it a lot to just navigate the UI. And I was playing Civilization 6 on my iPad last night. And I was actually just using, again, the Apple Pencil as like a mouse, as a pointing device, just to navigate that UI. Because it's been ported from I guess, the Mac version and the PC version. So some of the elements are a little bit small. And just using that Apple Pencil for that extra precision is really nice.
That sounds like fun.
It's a lot of fun. It also makes you feel cool because you're like a commander of your army. Like you're sitting there with your pencil commanding your nation. It feels cool.
I mean, just look at what Ben Thompson does with paper and those diagrams. He asks his protectory all the time. It's amazing the different kinds of things that people do with Apple Pencil.
Yeah, it's really, really awesome.
So one of the things that we got to see at the event was Photoshop for iPad Pro, which is coming in 2019. And it's a huge challenge just to get the behemoth. That code base must go back to the Fred Flintstone years of coding. just to get all that up and running on an iPad, which is, of course, like hugely RAM constrained. But it got me thinking, people keep asking for Xcode on iPad. And that's non-trivial in so many ways. But could you see a world where it's sort of like Photoshop, where you have like the full version with every conceivable workflow possible on your Mac, some sort of cloud link for all the files you're working on, and a subset of that that you can easily access and work on from your iPad. And I don't want to call it diet Xcode because Cable Sasser will sue me, but some sort of bifurcated workflow where you just have the ability to do major things with you wherever you are.
I have used Swift Playgrounds sometimes, and I mostly use it for fun, but I've also used it sometimes to actually like, I need this simple class that can talk to this API, so I'm just going to write it real quick here in Swift Playgrounds. And if I can get some work done with Swift Playgrounds, even though it's a very tiny amount of work, any type of Xcode, anything that's a little bit more powerful than Playgrounds would definitely make me use the iPad more. So yeah, I believe I could do some real work on iPad if I had more powerful tools.
Yeah, I like the way you phrase it there, like diet Xcode or like an Xcode Lite, And this is, for me, the way the iPad could really fit into, I think, a lot of people's workflow, where it's not necessarily taking the whole Xcode and moving it onto the iPad, because that would kind of, defeat the purpose, right? Like, it's the same reason you wouldn't want to just copy macOS and paste it onto the iPad. It wouldn't fit, right? So you would want some different version. Like, you want some kind of different way of working, and maybe just as a complement to your standard workflow. So one thing I've been thinking a lot about is, you know, if we were able to maybe edit parts of an app, like when we're building apps, to build them in a more like a component-driven way and to build them in a more decoupled way. And then you could open up one of those components, like one part of the app, like one view or one screen or one framework or one part of the code base, and maybe work on that. And you could do that using Swift Playgrounds, actually, and you could import that, but currently involves kind of a lot of hassle, and having that cloud-based storage, or even maybe connecting to like your Git server, right? And again, this is something you can do kind of on the iPad, but it's, again, it could be more integrated, where you could just pull down part of your app, you could start working on it, and then push those changes back. I think that could be really powerful, because if I'm doing something which is more like a little bit more lightweight in nature, let's say I'm doing some UI development, or maybe I'm just like debugging something, for example, if I could pull down some part of the app and do that on the iPad, maybe even use the pencil for some tasks, that could be really cool, and then go back to my Mac later. So for me, I really do two different modes of coding. I do like app development, but I also write a lot of articles. And when I write articles, that involves a lot of sample code, like coming up with sample code. And the last article I wrote last Sunday, I actually did all the sample code and I wrote the entire article on the iPad. And that was really great for that. So I think Swift Playgrounds has potential to become a more kind of more robust tool. But I think it needs that like really good connection to the mother Xcode running on the Mac to be able to integrate more easily.
Yeah, you could do something like you work with your code on iPad, but you need like a Mac server behind the scenes if you want to actually compile the entire project. But then it just does that transparently for you and sends the compiled result back so you can run it on the same device. That would be a possibility. And like currently with Playgrounds on iPad, you don't even know which error occurred, if it's a runtime error. So if you mess something up and you try to like unwrap a new value, it won't tell you what happened. It just shows you, oh, there's been an error. Check
yeah,
your code.
Exactly.
And if you open console on your Mac and connect your iPad, you see that it actually logs to the Mac console which error has occurred. So they know the error, but they are just didn't bother even just displaying an alert with the localized description for the error. So that's like a very basic thing that if they fix that, it would make Playgrounds a lot more viable as a coding platform on iPad.
It's very clear when you open up Swift Playgrounds what it was built for. That it was built for teaching and it was built for people learning how to code. Because the first thing you see is you see these like lessons, you see these cute characters that you can control using code. And you really have to like click a few buttons in order to actually, you know, just create a blank playground to start coding. So I definitely feel like if maybe even Playgrounds is not the right tool for what we want to do when we're doing like more app development, maybe it would be something like Xcode Lite that's like a separate app, because I feel like the current iteration of the Playgrounds app doesn't really cater to those use cases.
Yeah, you used to not be able to create a blank playground either. You had to like open up the Playgrounds quote-unquote store and download a blank template. Now they have added a new empty playground button.
I thought you were going to say that you had to open up one of those game things with this character and like make the character do your code, right?
Like write your off cliff and then
yeah, exactly. Like write your algorithm in a way that this character will do the game, and it's like becomes you have to both write the right algorithm and finish the game. So it's
move forward. He's just shaking his head. Move forward. He's just shaking his
exactly.
head. Exactly. And then he starts writing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So It can improve a lot, and we could definitely use some cool developer tools on iPad. But I want to ask you two like a general question, since I don't have the new iPad Pro yet. I've ordered it. It should arrive in a few weeks. And now I just remember that I forgot to get the headphone dongle.
But you got your AirPods, so it's fine.
Yeah. So to sum it up, what's your general impression of this new iPad, and what have you guys been doing with it on a daily basis?
So, I mean, I really like it, but I'm a sucker for new technology. So anytime anyone does anything really cool, I just want to use it. But on a daily basis, I can do everything now, and I often do everything now on the iPad except for Final Cut Pro and Photoshop. And I know there are Photoshop-like apps on the iPad, you know, that are really good, but I just grew up using Photoshop. I've used it for decades, and it goes back to that muscle memory thing where I know where everything is, and I can do things so fast that the cost of transitioning to another tool for anything that I need to do in Photoshop, not just fun art stuff, isn't worth it to me. So I will almost always still go back to Photoshop and the Mac to do a bunch of graphics work. And Final Cut Pro, Serenity could do great things with iMovie on iPad, and because she was like a professionally trained film, she actually worked as a film editor, so she knew that stuff backwards and forwards, and she was really great at using it. But I've done video editing for a long time, but I still feel comfortable in Final Cut Pro in a way that I don't in iMovie, and I can use a lot of the features in Final Cut Pro that just don't exist in iMovie. So I still go back to the Mac for Photoshop and Final Cut, but everything else, especially when I'm traveling or I leave the house, I just use the iPad Pro now, and I love writing on it. Almost all the stuff that I write is done on that, and I use a split view mode, because the split view mode on macOS is still garbage. You have to like assemble it and then destroy it and assemble it again. And the one on iOS works so well now that I just have my notes on one side, my research on the other, and I go to town, and everything else, messaging and whatever, is just great on iOS.
Yeah. I've been trying to do all work that I can on the iPad, and that's basically all work that is not just writing code for an app, right? So I mentioned earlier that I was writing my weekly article on the iPad. I was doing some prototyping on it. I was doing architectural work. I was even doing drafting a contract for a client, invoicing, of course, a lot of just messaging and things like that, Twitter. But I've been really trying to like only use the Mac for Xcode and for like development work, and then use the iPad for everything else. And I don't know if that's what I'm going to end up doing in the long run, but I really love this device a lot, and it's really delightful to use, and it's so light, you know, and it feels so great to use it that I want to use it as much as I can, and especially with like things like ProMotion and when you can use the Apple Pencil for drawing out things and things like that. But at the same time, I don't want to jump through too many hoops in order to use it. So I'm going to try to find all the tasks that I do on a weekly or daily basis that are a better fit for the iPad and do those on the iPad, and then do the rest of my tasks on the Mac. I think that's what I'm going to end up doing in the long run.
The reason I do most things on the Mac, even the things I could be doing on iPad, is laziness, basically, because I'm already sitting in front of my Mac, so why just don't use it. So I end up currently using my iPad. I have the 11-inch iPad Pro. I use it mostly for watching videos while I have dinner. That's like the specific reason for which I use it. And sometimes like on the weekends, it's like my breakfast computer, so I set it up and on the breakfast table, and I have some coffee and read the news and Twitter, and I use it that way. I've been trying to use it more lately, and I've used it for my latest article that's on rambo.codes. I've used it for the sample code, basically. So same as you, John.
Nice. That's awesome. Yeah, I think it really, like Renee also said, like the iPad works really well for this sort of task when you have like split view, basically, right? When you have like your Markdown on the right and you have your Swift Playground or your code editor or whatever you're using on the left. And you can just do both of these two things at the same time. You can slide them over very easily in order for one thing to take up more space. And I think that way of working works really, really well on the iPad. So I'm looking forward to doing more of that sort of work. And to your point, like I'm already in front of my Mac. I think the reason it works really well for me is that the way I usually work is that I time box everything and I try to only do one task at a time. So if I'm fixing a bug or I'm working on something for a customer, I do that and I do it for maybe 1 hour, 2 hours. And then I'm switching to something else. Let's say that I have another client I work for and I'm doing a code review for them. Let's say that as an example. You know, that works really well because I'm already switching the task. So then I can pick up the iPad, I can go sit down on my couch, and I can actually do that code review from the iPad instead. And I think that way of working fits really well with the way I think. So one thing that's come up a lot, and it keeps coming up every single time the iPad gets more powerful, is can you replace a Mac with an iPad? You know, this is the number one question people are asking. And every time you're posting something about the iPad being great, there's someone there saying, well, the Mac is better. So,
and vice versa.
Exactly. And I wanted to have your take on this, Renee, as someone who is reviewing a lot of these different products and, you know, obviously writing and hearing a lot from a lot of people, I presume. Is this something you're thinking a lot about as well? Is this in your line of thinking? Or how do you feel about this kind of big question?
Yeah, I mean, I think in a lot of ways, just to cut to the point, I don't think the iPad isn't a laptop replacement or was ever meant to be a laptop replacement. I think laptop alternative is a way better way of looking at it. And I know a lot of people got confused by Apple's presentation when they showed that graph of iPad sales versus laptop sales and said, oh, see, Apple's calling it a laptop. But when I read that graph, it was like, look at how many people are buying an iPad instead of a laptop, not as a laptop, but instead of a laptop, because for whatever reason, again, maybe traditional computers were always just too complicated, too alienating, too inaccessible to them. And this is a computing paradigm that's directly manipulable and just in so many more ways makes so much more sense to them. Like they don't know or care what a terminal is. It's the same as a punch card to them at this point.
Right.
And they're much happier with this. And I think that's fine. I don't think every computer has to be for every person. I think we live in a time of embarrassing riches where you can pick everything from a phone, if that's the only computing platform you have, through iPads and tablets and Surfaces and whatever, Pixelbooks, all the way up to Mac Pros and gaming workstations and all these things, and you just pick the one that's right for you. So I don't buy into it being like a replacement for anything. I think the biggest indicator of that is that Apple debuted the MacBook Air in the same event as the iPad Pro, because they are for very different customers. And I think that's mostly two types of people. One is the type of person who doesn't want a computer, and this lets them do very computer-like things with something that's clearly not a computer. And other people, and you know, I have to credit Gruber with this line because I think it's brilliant, other people who the lightness of the iPad lets them have a much heavier Mac. Like if they could only have one, they'd have to have maybe a MacBook Air, maybe a MacBook Pro, but they don't want that. They want a Mac Pro or a Mac Mini or an iMac. And because of that, they can take an iPad with them and, you know, do a subset of things that are really important. And it goes back to me, you know, my father was an IBM engineer and he had to go downtown to work on mainframes. Then he got an Apple II at home and he could run VisiCalc on it. He didn't have to go downtown anymore. And now I have a phone and I don't have to go back to my computer, as silly as that sounds. And then I have a watch and I don't have to look at my phone as often as I do. And you can sort of, everything is a subset. Everything can do less than the bigger version of it, but it can do important things in the moment that are sufficient for you. So I kind of stay away from that whole, can it replace a laptop? And I think iPad is a very different sort of computer. It still has its own constraints that I think Apple absolutely has to address. But I think people who are trying to look at it to replace a laptop would still be way happier using a laptop.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's kind of funny when you hear people say, you know, it can't replace a laptop because it doesn't have a mouse or something like that. And whenever I hear something like that, I always think back to that, you know, Steve Ballmer video, you know, when he looks at the iPhone and he says, it can never be successful because it doesn't have a physical keyboard.
Yeah.
And like to your point, like for some people, you definitely need that. Like you definitely need the full power of a Mac, and that's fine. But for so many people and for so many different tasks also, like, if you can have both a Mac and an iPad and you can perform different tasks on different ones, then that's great. And the fact that we have this this ability to choose the form factor that we wish, I think is just a great, great thing. So I also don't think you need to look at it like black or white, like it either needs to completely replace the Mac or it's a failure. I think complementing the Mac is really the key here, and complementing especially specific tasks that this sort of form factor with just one big screen with a pen with all that stuff does a lot better than what a traditional, you know, PC or computer can do.
And you can tell me if I'm off base with this, because I sometimes think I'm too harsh about it, but You know how like anybody who lives north than more north than you is a northerner? It doesn't matter where you live. If there's someone a village north of you, they're the northerner. It always seems like anybody who does your workload or more is a pro. And anybody who does less than you to any degree is just not a pro and shouldn't be considered, no matter what they manage to do. And I think there is sort of that sort of taking fire from the gods and sharing it with the mere mortals that just offends some people at a very core level. And I really hope we can get past that and just let people be them. Like you do you. If all you need is what a 9.7 inch iPad nothing can do, that's great. And it lets you do that. And I think Apple very consciously, they're getting back into the pro market huge this year, but I think very consciously they lent away from that, away from power users into empowering users. I talked about Final Cut Pro before. Final Cut Pro lets me edit video way better than I have any right to. If I had to do that in Premiere, it would be painful for me, and my videos would be worse for it. And I know a lot of pro editors had problems with the new version of Final Cut Pro, but it let a lot of new people, like a vastly larger group of people, become pro level or produce pro level video, or I should say. And I think, you know, we're in the bubble of Twitter and podcasts where you have a bunch of high order bit computer nerds talking about their needs and seeing things from their perspective. But I would guess, and I think this is why we see what we see from Apple in terms of all of their machines, the mainstream audience for these things dwarfs the sort of tech audience on Twitter. And yeah, they're literally laughing all the way to the bank when we're complaining about some of this stuff.
Yeah, you said it very well. Like, people tend to think that pros are like, I don't know, movie producers or programmers and stuff like that, or journalists. But like, I think two areas where the iPad is being used a lot is the healthcare industry, like by medical professionals, and airline pilots as well. And I don't think anyone would say those are not professionals.
I hope not.
The guy who does all the storyboards for like Pacific Rim and Star Trek Discovery and all that does it all on an iPad Pro, and he's so pro, I can't even imagine, you know, not someone discounting that kind of workload.
He's like super pro.
So good. His art is just so good.
Yeah, absolutely. And one big thing I think with this whole discussion is a little bit about, you know, you might be really used to a certain workflow, or you might be really used to things working a certain way. And the iPad is in many ways taking that and kind of flipping it upside down, right? So me, when I use the iPad now, and like I mentioned, I haven't been using the iPad for years, I was very disconnected from it. I wasn't like up to date with a lot of this stuff. And I needed to kind of adapt myself in order to actually make the way I use this device actually fit the way it's designed. And I can see a lot of people who look at that and they're like, no, I don't want to do that. Just give me my Mac, please, right? Yeah. And that's fine. That's great. But for me, like, I'm super interested in it, and I want to see if I change my way of working to suit this device and to use it in the way it's supposed to be used, or designed to be used, I guess, what can I achieve? And the answer is, well, an awful lot, actually.
Yeah.
Some people frame that as the person needs to adapt to the device, and it should be the other way around. But that's not the case. The case is that you are so used to doing things a certain way, yeah, that it will require you to adapt, because if you want to adapt, because we are creatures of habits, and when we need to change a habit, we don't feel great about it.
No, that's very true. I mean, that was the big discovery with the original Palm, right? Where Jeff Hawkins realized that he could never get the Palm to recognize graffiti, to recognize handwriting, but if you got people to change just a tiny amount, then it would be perfect.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I think the same goes also for software design and for the way we design apps for this thing, where I think that a lot of kind of conventions that we have from the Mac are kind of brought over, and it's not always a perfect fit. For example, if you look at something like text input, right, where on the Mac you have your mouse, you have your keyboard, you can do the traditional kind of text input in a very efficient manner. But on the iPad, that's not really the case. So one thing that I started doing was, like I mentioned, I started exploring some things with Apple Pencil and started prototyping to see like how could text input also be made easier using alternative methods, maybe doing some more like tokenization and being able to drag things around easier and things like that. But also as a user, one thing that I started doing a lot was I started doing a lot of dictation. And it turns out that dictation works really great on the iPad, actually. And a big part of my article that I wrote was actually dictated. So I think, you know, trying to find these alternative designs and alternative uses, I think it does require a lot of work. But once you do, it becomes a really, really interesting device.
Yeah, you convinced me to try out dictation.
Yeah, I was dictating like a whole chat with me and Rambo, like, you know, completely dictated, and then Rambo was sending me some messages, and then he said, well, guess what, I dictated these messages.
Yeah, it works very well.
Yeah, cool. So we've talked a lot now about the iPad, like some pros and cons and things like that, and how we use it, but what I think we should do to kind of round off this episode is to talk a little bit about what's our wish list for future features, either on the hardware itself or in iOS. Like, if we want to take the iPad to the next level, either as, you know, for developers or for general purpose audience or whichever view we want to take, what do we think are some of the things that could really improve and we wish would improve on the iPad? Renee, what do you think?
I mean, the three on the top of my list we sort of already talked on, but it's nice to round them up. And that is, I'm going to use your name, ProBoard, as a new front level interface system for the iPad. Better ways of understanding peripherals is built into the operating system, whether that, you know, that's like files app understanding, external storage, and a better support for interface navigation from pencil and keyboard, so that you can effectively do very granular, detail oriented interface interactions, both by using the keyboard to navigate and by just sitting there with the pencil and doing almost anything you can imagine, like, you know, like we talked about, making a quick lasso to select things, all that kind of stuff.
I definitely agree with Renee, especially about ProBoard. I really feel like we need this shelf kind of functionality on iPad to make it easier to navigate around and exchange information between apps. They did a great job with drag and drop, and I think they can take it to the next level. And another thing I would love to have, and this is not for just the iPad, but I believe it makes more sense on iPad because it's so powerful and it has a bigger battery, are headless extensions for apps. I believe apps should be able to have separate processes to handle specific tasks, and that's not currently possible unless you're doing like notification extensions or Siri extensions, which is something that Apple allows you to do. But I think we need something more beyond that. And also, we didn't talk about shortcuts, but I would love if we could make shortcut extensions for our apps that can take inputs and give outputs so they can be used inside shortcuts workflows in a more flexible way than they are now.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Like, being able to build custom building blocks into shortcuts, that would be really, really amazing. Yeah. And with headless apps, do you mean like almost like services or daemons that are running in the background that can just like do work on an ongoing basis, or something that the user can invoke?
I mean, like, if the app wants to do, this is not that useful on an iPad, but if the app wants to do like background location monitoring for some reason, it can spawn a separate process to do that and not have to run the entire app in the background.
Oh, right. I see. Yeah. Yeah, that would be really cool. For me, I also agree with the shortcuts one. I would love to be able to use shortcuts more. And this is something I really think is going to happen as well, like for shortcuts to continue to evolve. One thing I would love to do is to be able to map a shortcut to a keyboard command so that you could say like, you know, command some letter or command shift some letter and run a shortcut in the background. Like let's say, for example, to enable do not disturb and to turn the volume to a certain degree or something like that. That would be really cool, because that way you could do a lot of powerful features yourself. You wouldn't have to rely on the operating system to implement them. And to also enable things like Swift Playgrounds, for example, to actually run a playground and return the results, so that we could write kind of our own scripts in Swift and actually have them run. And if you combine these two features, you could essentially have your own little mini programs, your own little mini apps that you can actually invoke by a keyboard shortcut. And one really concrete example I have where I would really love to use this is to do text manipulation. Like, let's say that you select a link somewhere and then you want to turn that into like a markdown link, and maybe you want to put that in a certain format or something like that for your website. To be able to do all that with one keyboard command would be really cool. And you can do that on the Mac with lots of these like third-party tools like Keyboard Maestro and things like that, and with Apple scripts. But that obviously will probably not be moved over to iOS. But I think using shortcuts for these sort of things could be really, really powerful.
Love that. That's a big wish list.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always have big wish lists. You know, I'm a dreamer. All right, so we've now reached the end of this episode. So all that remains is for us to thank you very much, Renee, for joining us as our special guest.
Oh, no, thank you for having me. That was a blast.
Yeah, it was so much fun. So we mentioned earlier that you are writing and you are doing videos and podcasts and things like that. So if people want to catch up on your work, what's the best way to find you and find the work that you do?
You can go to imore.com/vector or to youtube.com/vectorshow. And all of it is right there.
Perfect. That's really great. And also on Twitter, you are at Renee Ritchie.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, perfect. That's a good follow. And like always, you can find Mr. Rambo on Twitter as well. He is at _inside. You can find me on Twitter at John Sundell. And you can find everything about this show at stacktracepodcast.fm. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. And we'll talk to you on the next episode. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.